Well, we've looked at a secular age, a secular age, and today a self-actualized age. That's our culture, isn't it? Everyone can be who they have been told that they can be. They can be the self-actualized person. And I was in Target in Midland, which is in Perth. I went to Target to see what other people buy for clothing, and I saw the writing on the wall. I saw this. This is the vision statement of Target Australia. It is written on the back wall of Target in Midland in big bold letters. Every Australian has the right to look good and feel good about the way they dress and live. If you, next time you go to Target, it may not be in your Target, but it's certainly in our Target. Every Australian has the right to look good and feel good about the way they dress and live. It's the vision statement of Target Australia. Now, back in the day, when John Howard was looking for a preamble to the Australian Constitution, he could have done worse, couldn't he? Because that pretty much could sum up the Australian way of thinking. Now, repeat after me. One, two, three. Every Australian has the right to look good and feel good about the way they dress and live. Target wants us to get that into our heads, right? Target wants us to walk around repeating that as a mantra as we shop, right? Wrong. You see, Target's vision statement is not targeting our heads at all, is it? It is not designed to get us to memorise that vision as we push our trolleys or carry our baskets around shopping. Target's vision statement is targeting your heart. And the power of Target's vision statement comes into play not as we say it, but as we do it. It's a vision of self-actualisation, and self-actualisation does not work at brain level, but heart level. As we shop, as we go to the mall, the shopping centre, or go online these days, the very action of doing that shapes our practices and embeds those practices in our hearts as the things that we love and then start to shape us. James Smith calls such practices, if you've read it, cultural liturgies. He's making a very pointed remark that everything is liturgical, not just Sunday. As I said the other day, we are going to a second service when we go to church on Sunday because we have been to an incredible discipleship program Monday to Saturday, and we need laundered from it on Sunday. Here's how James Smith describes a cultural liturgy. Liturgies are ritual practices that form our identity. Liturgies inculcate into us a vision of the good life. They do so in a way that means to trump other liturgies. Liturgies are the most loaded forms of cultural practices that aim to form our identity, that inscribe in us a vision of what the good life looks like, the self-actualized life, a vision of the good life. Target's vision of the good life is unashamedly the self-actualized self. Even though at no stage does it justify why such things are our rights. Who determines? Are those universal rights? Are those just Australian rights? Are those just rights in Midland? Who determines what ethical platform pronounced that? And who determined what ethical rights we could trample over of other people in order to look good about how, you know, feel good about how we dress and live? There might be some factory workers in Bangladesh who might have something to say about that. But it's true, is it not? The primary self-actualized right of our age is to feel good. And whatever makes you feel good, barbecues, for example, just plucking an example from whatever makes you feel good is what self-actualizes you. That's why we form our tribal associations, or we self-actualize commonly with other people who are self-actualizing about the same thing. Across the road from where we've just moved is the primary school, and every Sunday morning, the medieval reconstructionists appear with swords and and lances and chainmail and fight to the death. There's a whole church of, you know, medieval knights basically fighting each other. that is their church. It is where they heal their hurts. They're self-actualizing. But we do it in many sophisticated ways, don't we? Whatever makes us feel good is what self-actualizes us. These are the rights of every Australian, and we are fighting upstream against that framework when, as Ken said, you have to become small or little to enter the kingdom. So when we think liturgy, as James Smith puts it, we bifurcate life between the religious life and the secular life, but everyone's a worshipper, as David Foster Wallace said in his famous commencement speech at Kenyon College. Everyone worships. The only thing we get to decide is who or what we worship. But often our culture thinks of the word as a religious setting, but liturgy tells us that everything we do is embedded practice. And the more we do it, the more it shapes us. We think we're shaping it. It's shaping us. And my concern as a church pastor is at the very time that the cultural practices, the liturgies that sway us, that so affect our hearts, the very time that they're so strong and so persuasive and pervasive and often so toxic, what's happened is that the Christian community has done one of two things, or both of them, in fact. The first thing is that we've neglected our own liturgies, both in word and practice, and we've also baptized the culture's liturgies within our Christian communities. Here's what I mean. First, we've neglected our own liturgy in word and practice. We now have a church generation, several actually, who have either no or extremely thin theological frameworks and ecclesiological practices. Remember I mentioned that we did communion every week at our church. And people railed against that for a long time. Like, I'm not sort of trying to use my people at church as an experiment. Okay, I am. But I tested the theory. There will be pushback if we have communion this way every week. There will be for a while. And then either I've ground people down, which isn't the case, because people love it. They miss it if we've not had it. And we don't not have it. Well, traditionally, you don't have it on, is it Good Friday or Easter Sunday? There, I've forgotten. But when you don't have communion, people notice. It's an embedded practice. They want to respond to the gospel that they've heard. They want to be sent out after taking it. We do it to embed the practice in our lives in order that we grow to know it. No? To love it. To love it. To desire communion, to feed spiritually on Christ. Wow, I'm sounding a little less Baptist than what I thought I did. Because we go, oh, it's just to remember stuff, just to remember stuff. No, it's to grow to love it because of what it says. To desire to eat the bread and drink from the cup. To see that it reorients us towards going out with an embedded practice in our life that shapes us during the week. And that we go out, as it says at the end of the service, in peace, to love and serve the Lord. Now, why are those words said at the end of a service? Go in peace to love and serve the Lord. Because we go in peace with God. We go justified before God to love and serve Him. Because we are justified, because we have peace with Him, we don't need to go out into the Monday to Friday week to seek our justification in our jobs or our lives and families. We are justified. Because if you go into that week unsure of your justification, everything you do, even though on the surface it may look like it's serving other people, it's actually serving yourself. It's your justification. And when it's going really, really well and people really, really love you, you can hide the fact that it's your self-justification. But when it goes wrong and you get angry, you know that you're seeking your justification there. Ministers can put up their hand and say, you know, we've got all the theological words for it, but it's a very easy profession to see where people get bitter. And justification is the primary issue. We go in peace to love and serve the Lord so that we're not angling with people, using them as our means to an end for justification. If your church or Christian community framework sends you out to do more, try harder, achieve for God more often, then it's not the gospel. You're not going out in peace, justified, to love and serve the Lord. Of course, it's more than that with liturgies. Our liturgies at church, our embedded practices, must contain the thick practices of hospitality, holiness, forgiveness, serving of others, the one another stuff. We're supposed to embed those practices into our lives as well, so that they become almost unconscious, our default. That's what they're supposed to do. It's like if you're going to eat healthily, and someone was watching me eat breakfast this morning and I was not eating healthily, but if I'm an unhealthy eater, I'm sort of unconscious that I'm an unhealthy eater. And then suddenly I have an epiphany and I realise I am an unhealthy eater. I'm a conscious unhealthy eater. And that's where we park, right? You know, and then we self-loathe, you know. And then eventually we say, I've got to eat more healthily. So we're shopping and we go to go down that aisle and we say, get behind me, Satan, my sweet tempter of all. And you go down the good aisle and you become a conscious healthy eater. And that is exhausting, right? That is exhausting. You do not want to be a conscious healthy eater all your life. You want to move to the stage of unconscious healthy eating, that it becomes your default. Because it's too tiring to remain a conscious, healthy eater all the time. It just is. That's not to say that we unthinkingly act as Christians, but default is a great place to be with embedded practice. Embedded practice means you walk down the right aisle not thinking about it. Now, how far is that from thinking of the average church attendee or the average Christian sending your kids to school? Not only have we neglected our liturgical practices, however, we've baptized the culture's liturgies so often. Two generations of mall-type church expressions have not jolted people out of the false liturgy that every Australian has the right to look good and feel good about the way they dress and live. Which is why I'm a little bit suspicious of six sermons on financial freedom or five sermons on how to live better in this world. Rather than push against that, we have often embedded the liturgical practices of the culture. In speaking of his own children and their experiences of the mall, Jamie Smith observes, the mall is not just a place for them to go, the mall wants them. That's the other one. It wants their hearts. It wants their loves. There's a vision of the good life implicit in the practices of the mall that, when enacted over time, inscribes that vision on their hearts. Even the way the shopping centre is laid out is designed to get you in there to have a spiritual experience, so to speak. No clocks, lots of artificial light, a cruciform-shaped building. You go in there, you make the transaction, and it is transactional. It's a transactional religion. The mall wants us. It wants our loves, or whatever the mall is for you, the online one. And when we enact its practices over time, we give it our love. That's how it works. That's how everything works in our lives. So maybe Michelle was talking about her boot and her sore leg, and I seem to default to talk about running. Now, I was 43 when I started running after being sick for about a year, and I took up running, and I love running. How did I take up running? Did I go and buy a year's subscription to Runner's World before I ran? Let's read to see what this running is about, and maybe I could grow to love it. Did I go onto eBay and look at the feverishly search for trainers that were half price because you churn through them and buy 10 pair? Maybe I'll grow to love running. No. What did I do? I ran. And by the practice of it over time, it embedded itself on my heart as a love, so that I will spend silly amounts of discretionary income on Runner's World trainers and occasionally physio. I get antsy when I don't run. It's an embedded practice. Now that's both a positive and a negative, isn't it? When God's people embed the mall practices, a consumer mentality, a pick-and-mix spirituality, and opt into community if it's not too hard and doesn't make too much demand, no church discipline, the customer's always right, these practices embed themselves over time as the way it should be, as the things that we love. So when the gospel says self-denial, when the gospel says take up your cross, when the gospel says husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church, when the gospel says die to sin, that requires costly engagement. When it says love those not like you or those you don't particularly like, if you've had an embedded practice of every Australian has the right to look good and feel good about the way they dress and live and do worship, those sorts of messages just slide off like Teflon. It's interesting that the cohort of people that are most difficult to work with in our church setting are between 50 and 60. I found that the hardest cohort, as I said, people who for 20 years have been to 7 different churches over 20 years. They're showing what they love. And their kids are taking note of it. School communities, as I said before, are at the front line. These are the places that we get to target the cultural liturgies and shape people's hearts away from those liturgies towards the word and practice liturgies of the gospel. We get to target what students love, not merely what they think, and therefore to shape their loves and hence their practices. Yes? That's the task you guys have in this culture where there are so many cultural liturgies that are multicoloured, multifaceted, and on their iPhone. You'll note by now that most of what I've said the last few days is targeting your heart, because we're suckers if we don't play target at its own game. It gets it. And I did that fairly unashamedly yesterday, I think. But it's pretty much all I do when I get on a stage. I'm a one-trick pony. Because I'm convinced that we operate overwhelmingly at heart level and then, and only then, at head level. We think it's the other way around. We come to logical conclusions and then act. But that's not true. We act and then come up with logical justifications for our actions. Decades of psychological theory in the 20th century pitched towards reason as the thing that shapes us, that we are lollipops, heads on sticks, and then action follows reason. Reason, it was seen, was a jockey, emotions, or our hearts, were smallish horses, and there's a pathway that we should take, and we lean the horse down the pathway by deducing what we should do. The jockey forms an opinion, then steers the horse down the path. Jonathan Haidt, academic and psychologist at New York University, has blown this idea out of the water through a series of experiments summed up in a best-selling book, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. And he was a fairly liberal Democrat in the US, wondering why people voted the way they did and thought the way they did, and why in the 80s and 90s the liberal consensus or the liberal perspective wasn't getting traction. And he wrote this book called The Righteous Mind, and he realised that people don't operate like we just said at all. He said, reason is still the jockey. That is true. But emotion is not a horse. It is an elephant. It is a rampaging bull elephant with a very small jockey sitting on top of it. And whatever path the elephant chooses to head down, guess what? The jockey leans towards it. The jockey leans towards the direction that the elephant has already chosen. the gap in time between the elephant's decision and the jockey's leaning is so small as to be imperceptible and also to fool you into thinking that you are making reasonable decisions when you are actually making gut-level emotional decisions first. Very small, but the experiments show that's where it is. It's there. If you want to change the direction of your students in their lives, you need to work on the elephant, not just the jockey. Our directions are not shaped by what we know, but by what we want. Don Carson tells the sobering story of being in Scotland and speaking to a minister who, the minister was telling him about this young man who grew up in their church. And this young man had wanted to lead the youth group, so he did. And this young man had wanted to date the young woman in the church, so he did. And he had wanted to go to university to study medicine, and he did. And he wanted to come back to that town and practice medicine and marry that girl, so he did. And he wanted to run off with his secretary, so he did. And Don Carson expressed shock at what had happened, because it had seemed to come out of the blue. This young, upstanding Christian man who's a doctor and helping in the church and suddenly runs off with his secretary. And the Scottish minister said, "I'm not surprised at all. At every stage of his life, he did what he wanted. No barriers. Our direction is not shaped by what we know, but by what we want." And Jonathan Haidt, in his experiments, found this to be convincingly the case. Of course, we could have all told him that theologically some time ago when Archbishop Thomas Cranmer said what the heart loves, the will chooses, and the mind justifies. What the heart loves, the will chooses, and the mind justifies. That's jockey, pathway, elephant, right there. The elephant moves down the pathway, and the jockey leans in. Let me give you two examples. Chocolate cake and sex, two of the staples of the Western diet, often coterminous. See, there's a piece of chocolate cake. I'm working out. I run. I can have that cake. It's low in calories. Why should I not treat myself? I work hard enough. A desire kicks in first, followed by our reasons afterwards. Life has been tough. My spouse and I fight all the time. I was probably going to leave her at some stage anyway. Why should I not treat myself? This marriage is hard enough. We make a decision, and then we justify it. That's the way we operate. What the heart loves, the will chooses, and the mind justifies. You have all sorts of pedagogical and academic tasks, information to impart, but your kids are not lollipops, not heads on sticks. They are small jockeys on large elephants. Reason leans towards desire. And then we do what we want and back engineer the story to justify. That's the culture we're in. That's the way we're made. And I say that's the way we're made because it's not wrong to be made like that in one sense, because the theological reason we are shaped by our desires is that we were created to be shaped by desire. God intended it. Desire is not the problem. Misdirected desire is the problem. In a book which I thought otherwise was quite good, On Desire, Why We Want What We Want, William Irvine, who's not a Christian, makes this classic error in a chapter entitled Religious Advice. He states this: almost all religions require adherents to curb their desires, and almost all religions offer advice on how desire can be curbed. We can no more curb desire than a five-year-old child can restrain the water gushing out of a fire hydrant in the street. Our desire, our problem is not desire expression, the solution to which is desire suppression. Our problem is misdirected desire. Elephants going down wrong pathways and jockeys leaning in. That's how sin works. That's how my sin works. I don't know about yours. Maybe you reason your way to your sin, but I justify my way to mine after desire has set in. Because that's exactly what Scripture says in James, does it not? When tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each person is tempted when they are dragged away by what? Their own reasons? Their own desires, evil desire and enticed. Then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and part of that sin is self-justifying the decision. And sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. The Bible tells us what we were created for desire, to desire God. But this is how good God is. God creates the garden and fills it with desirous things. A million desirous things to say yes to and one desirous thing to say no to. Notice that it is a desirous thing to say no to. God gives two people built to desire each other and built to desire God ultimately. What's the problem? When the woman sees the tree, what does the text say? It was a really ugly tree. It was like a prickly pear, you know? You couldn't go near the thing. And it didn't look all that appetizing. And it was tucked away sort of in a corner of the garden. It was a bit swampy. No. The tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise. It doesn't go on to say, she then curbed her misdirected desire. No, she misdirected her desires. The tree was good for food, delight to the eyes, desire to make one wise. The elephant went down the pathway, and the jockey leaned right in. And that's the story, isn't it, in the Bible, that when God brings humans into the new Garden of Eden, it's even bigger and more grand, the Promised Land, where like in the first garden, his people eat from trees they did not plant, drink from vines that they do not tend, live in houses that they do not build. It's completely and utterly a desire test. I have sated every desire you could have. Now will you worship me? Will you find your deepest desire in me, Israel? No, God, we will not. We will run after the Baals. Why? Because Baal is the fertility god, and in this kind of country, with a little bit of rain or a lack of rain occasionally, and we kind of need to, you know, procreate with bouncy baby boys to keep the tribes going, we will justify worshipping Baal. Elephant goes down the pathway. Jockey leans right in. And then there's the Asherah poles and every other sort of pagan idolatry. All justified, of course. All misdirected desires. See, advertising has it all over us. It plays the desire game. It's a game so sophisticated that our practices follow unthinkingly to the point where we can say we desire one thing, yet actually do another that proves our desires are elsewhere. We actually default time and time again to something other than what we say. We call that addiction. And in Luke 6, Jesus says to his followers, on again, off again, followers, why do you call me Lord, Lord, but not do what I say? Here's why. They are shaped to love other lords, other masters, by practices that embed that love within them, even at the very time they call Jesus Lord and they don't even see it. Now, imagine a room that if you entered it, would both expose and grant your deepest desire. The Stalker is a Russian film about exactly that. And in the movie, 1979 movie, there's actually been a book written about it after the movie, it was so influential. Two men, the writer and the professor, are led by the Stalker in this post-apocalyptic world, deeper and deeper into a very dangerous location called the Zone. And they're being led to a room, fairly destroyed looking, paltry looking room, to the room. And in the room, each man, each person that goes into that room, will receive exactly what their heart desires. That's the promise of the room. And to get there is a dangerous journey. And to get there, the writer and the professor are led by this character called the Stalker, and it becomes a deep philosophical journey as well as a dangerous one. It's thrilling and exciting. Except for this, the closer they get to the room, the less sure they become. What if I don't know what I want? Asks one. Well, says the Stalker, that's for the room to decide. The room reveals all. What you get is not what you think you wish for, but for what you most deeply wish for. Let me repeat that. What you get is not what you think you wish for, but for what you most deeply wish for. Can you understand the hesitancy? No, after you. No, I insist. You know. And the Stalker goes on to say this: not many people can confront the truth about themselves. If they did, they'd run a mile, would take an immediate and profound dislike to the person in whose skin they'd learned to sit quite tolerably all these years. Another man who goes in before them has had a long-term stated desire down many years. And his desire has been for his beloved brother not to have died. And he has made his way to the room, to enter the room, to get his brother back from death. Now is his chance to get back what he desires. He enters the room and is immediately showered with wealth beyond his wildest dreams and commits suicide. What you get is not what you think you wish for, but for what you most deeply wish for, which is why the psalmist says, Lord, cleanse me from what kind of faults? Hidden faults. Hidden faults. In a self-actualized age, we think we're in control. Every ad tells us we are. We think we are there to decide, that we know what we want. We think we are in control of getting it, that we stand above our decisions, and it turns out that our decisions stand above us. Jeremiah 17:9, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it? I, the Lord, search the heart and test the mind to give every man according to what? According to what he thinks? No, according to his ways. According to the fruit of his deeds. Our loves are shaped by what we do, embedded practices, cultural liturgies that are reinforced by their enacting. So we do what we love, and what we love, and we love what we do. It's like a Mobius strip, forever turning in on itself, reinforcing itself. Ah! Do you feel that? And in case this all sounds doom and gloom, it's not a call to despair. Because James Smith says there's a better vision, or Glyn Harrison, as he said, there's a better story. There's a better story. Now, we often quote Acts 17 in our current generation, Paul's sermon in Athens, as the one that helps us shape the gospel towards a post-Christian culture. But there's a lesser known, lesser quoted Acts sermon by Paul that nails what I'm saying. And it's Paul's sermon in Acts 14 as Paul and Barnabas are sharing the gospel in the city of Lystra. Paul heals a crippled man and everyone's amazed to the point where the crowds decide that Paul and Barnabas are gods. How do they respond? When the apostles, Barnabas and Paul, heard of this, they tore their clothes and rushed out into the crowd shouting, Friends, why are you doing this? We too are only humans like you. We are bringing you good news, telling you to turn from these worthless things to the living God who made the heavens and the earth and the sea and everything in them. In the past, he let all nations go their own way, yet he has not left himself without testimony. He has shown kindness by giving you rain from heaven and crops in their seasons. He provides you with plenty of food and fills your hearts with joy. See, the problem in Lystra is exactly the problem in 21st century West. Kindness, plenty of food, joy, gods who deliver those things. They are first floor projects pushed upstairs. They are taken as ends in themselves. Human flourishing as the goal of human flourishing. But Paul says, those good things are the kindness of God. He has not left himself without testimony. You should look at those things and go, what a great giver there must be. They are testimony to a deeper goal, the only second floor project that works, the goal of worshipping the living God. It is the kindness of God that leads us to repentance. Let's never forget that. Paul's sermon at Lystra is the sermon for our times, I reckon, not his Athens sermon. Because we're not sitting in our culture debating some new idea. The gay marriage soldier video yesterday was not an idea, was it? It was a desire, a love, a story. We're sitting around clicking on some new website, ordering some new item, inscribing the target vision of the good life onto our hearts through embedded practices, desire. So is there a way forward? Yeah, there is, and it's a challenge and a comfort that I want to leave you in this secular, sexual, or self-actualized world. John Piper quotes Psalm 16, where he says, in your presence there is fullness of joy, at your right hand there are pleasures forevermore. And he says, most people will put up with 80% joy for 80 years. 80% joy for 80 years. And they go, yeah, I'll take that. I'll take that. And that's a long shot anyway. Whoever gets 80% joy for 80 years, when God is offering fullness of joy, pleasures forevermore. Fullness of joy, pleasure as far as the eye can see. How terrible to miss out on that for the sake of 80% joy for 80 years. Our goal as Christians in community, whether school communities or church communities, is ultimately to capture people's hearts with a vision of the good life in God that trumps all other visions. Practices, liturgical practices that embed themselves in our lives first and then in the lives of the children and parents we engage with and the staff together so that the good life looks enjoyable, carries more weight. The people desire it, but the elephant goes down that path and the jockey leans in. So that Christianity looks like what it says on the tin. That there's a richness to community, a depth of love for each other, a desire to serve, freedom from self-justification in order to forgive others and ask for forgiveness, a vision of the good life that is beyond moralistic therapeutic deism. That's not only calling students to self-denial and away from self-actualization, but practicing those things ourselves. Tim Keller says that he wants the church in the city and the Christian institutions to live in such a way that people, even if they don't agree with us, would feel the lack of us should we leave or shut down. And those are real possibilities for Christian communities in the coming 15 to 20 years in Australia, as funding might dry up. That taxes would have to be raised to compensate for the good that we did and the bad we averted. Now that's no small task in a country like Australia, in which one Anglican diocese is selling off properties to pay the financial restitution of the victims of sex crimes by priests. It feels like we're in deficit mode every time you read something like that in the paper. But as I said yesterday, the bodies are reaching the shore from the first tsunami wave of the secular culture. The stories are being told and they're not pretty. The better story of that culture is failing and will continue to fail. It has a while to go, but the bodies are starting to wash up on the shore. People who have worked overtime to create the transcendence on the first floor that only the second floor can provide will come. And when they do, tired and worn out, battle scarred. Our goal is that they see a vision of the good life, the desirous life among us, that they experience a vision of the good life in Christ that has captured our hearts and so captures theirs, that has fulfilled our desires and so fulfills theirs. Thou hast formed us for thyself, and our hearts are restless till they find rest in thee. Amen.